I hate to tell you this, but it turns out that traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. I know, very disgusting. Not only is it extremely gross, but it also leads to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning, antibacterial bedding, such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacteria growth and require up to 3 times less laundry. If you get hot at night, you'll appreciate Miracle Made's self-cooling properties, which makes use of silver-infused fabrics inspired by NASA. If it's good enough for the astronauts, it's good enough for me. They are thermoregulating and designed to keep you at the perfect temperature all night long. It makes a huge difference in getting better sleep every night. If you hate sleeping in bacteria, which I'm sure you do, or you're looking to get rid of your worn and uncomfortable bedding, you should check out Miracle Made. You'll feel like you're tucked into a luxurious hotel fancy bedding situation, but it'll be a lower cost than some of those other brands. Go to trymiracle.com/thestacks to try Miracle Made sheets for you or a lucky loved one. Order today and save over 40%. Plus, if you use our promo code THESTACKS at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. Miracle is so confident in their product that it's backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. If you aren't 100% satisfied, you will get a full refund. Upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made. Go to trymiraclemade.com/thestacks and use the code THESTACKS to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40% off. Again, that's trymiracle.com/thestacks to treat yourself. Thank you, Miracle Made, for sponsoring this episode. Welcome to The Stacks, a podcast about books and the people who read them. I'm your host, Tracy Thomas, and our guest today is author, activist, and now podcast host, Darnell Moore. We talk about Darnell's wonderful memoir, No Ashes in the Fire, his new podcast, Being Seen, and of course, his taste in books. Darnell will also be our guest on December 30th to discuss Citizen, an American Lyric by Claudia Rankine for The Stacks Book Club. Thank you so much to The Stacks Pack, the folks who show this podcast love over on Patreon. They contribute to the show monthly and earn perks like discounts on our merch, access to our virtual book club, and more. I could not make this show without you. If you want to join this community of bookish people, head to patreon.com/thestacks. This week, I'm saying a special thank you to the newest members of the Stacks Pack: Bianca Rivera, Anne Lichty, Allison Punch, Claire Flores, Karen, Anastasia Ware, Meredith Wilkinson, and Heather Miller. Thank you all so much, and thank you to the entire Stacks Pack. Okay, it's on to my conversation with Darnell Moore. All right, everybody, I'm so excited. I am here today with author and activist and all around just exciting human podcaster now, Darnell Moore. Darnell, welcome to the Stacks.
I'm so excited to be in conversation with you. I'm fanning out right now.
Oh my God. I'm fanning out right now. This is going to be a love fest. I'm so excited. It's just going to be me giggling and being like, I'm so excited. Okay. We always sort of start here, which is, can you just kind of tell us about yourself? I've just given an intro that you have not heard, but it'll be like your resume. But like, tell us about you that's not, you know, like, I wrote this thing or I did that. Like, give us a little background.
Yes. So I am a child of Camden, New Jersey. Camden is in South Jersey across from Philadelphia. I was born there in a time during which Camden was talked about within the media space, within the sort of social sciences space even. You know, as a city that was sort of bereft of goodness and virtue, it made many lists, you know, being named one of the most economically devastated cities in the country, along the lines of like Gary, Indiana, right? It was talked about as one of the most violent places in the country. And I was quite aware of those designations as a young Aquarius, inquisitive, nerdy little boy growing up in Camden who read the newspaper and paid attention to how people talked about the city that I called home in the world, it is really important for me to name that my family really demonstrated radical Black love and helped me to understand and find true meaning and community. And that was a buffer. It isolated me from all of those negative arrows that were being shot from media, because as much as I knew it, Camden was like, shit, it was like an amazing place to be. Because my family in the home was so full of love. I was fortunate, even though as a child, I look back and I'm like, I don't know how we did it. But, you know, my grandparents had 8 kids and my mom was the second oldest. And she had me at 16, which means that I was born enough to see my aunts and uncles growing up themselves as kids. My mom was a teenager. So I had the benefit of being like the ninth child growing up in a home full of people. It was a 3-bedroom home with a basement. We were living in line all over the place. But it was like, you know, it was love.
Yeah.
It was love. And I just, that is who I am. I mean, it is very much at the heart of the work that I do as an artist, as a person who's done organizing in the world, as an educator, as a media maker. I'll end by saying, I always say this about my family. The house was full because whenever somebody came knocking on the door in need of a place to stay, and whether that meant I had to get on the floor and they took over the couch, or there were 3 people in one bed, I come from a family that never, ever shut the door or left the door shut on people. And they taught me about what it means to not dispose of our own. And as Black folk, who know something about disposability in a world that is easily ready to dispose of us, I learned a value of what it means to love radically. And that carried into my work and into the organizing work that I've done, into just the way I live my life. So I'm a child of Diane Chisholm, Black girl who had me at 16, who is the most amazing mom, the son of a father who had me at 15, and who, in a time in which Reagan were calling people like my mama welfare queens, raised a child to love with big heart. So that's who I am.
I love, like, the greatest introduction to oneself I've ever heard. We share being from a place that the media and the world likes to shit on. I'm from Oakland, California.
So shout out similar, to Oakland.
Yeah. I mean, I was raised in a very different way and, you know, not a similar upbringing, but a similar experience of where you're from, looking like one thing to the outside world and feeling like something very different to you as a child, and also understanding or not understanding what that means or looks like. I think we probably both, hearing you talk about Camden, I feel similarly. Like, I didn't really quite understand what everyone's fuss about Oakland was. You know, like, I got it, but I also didn't get it, you know. I'm gonna skip. I have like all these notes and things I want to talk to you about, but you kind of gave me like a perfect in, which is your mom. In your memoir, No Ashes in the Fire, which is just really, really beautiful, and we will talk about it more, but one of the things that stuck out to me, I listened to your memoir and your voice is perfect. But one of the moments in the book that just like gives me chills, like just thinking about it right now, it makes me emotional, is you're coming out to your mother. And it's I mean, I'm like gonna cry right now. It is such a beautiful, beautiful story. And as the reader, we've come with you on your journey, right? We've seen where you grew up. We've met your family. We've met your friends. We've kind of followed you as you've discovered your relationship and your sexual identity and all this stuff. And it's towards the end of the book. And that moment is just like, it gives me chills. It's just so beautiful because it is that acceptance and that radical Black love and that like all the things you just described about your upbringing. You can feel that in just the few sentences in that moment. And I just, I don't know. It's just such a great part of your book.
Thank you. I loved writing that part. I loved writing it for a few reasons. And just for context, for those that haven't read it, you know, part of what you feel as you're journeying with me through the story is the weightiness And weightiness, that doesn't necessarily mean traumatic, but the weightiness of being, of growing and coming of age as a Black person who's coming into their queerness, into their queer magic, right? In a very particular place, in a very particular part of, you know, time in the world, under very particular circumstances. But what is marvelous about it is, there's something that the world is supposed to think about a Black girl who had a child at 16, who drops out of high school, and doesn't get her GED until her son, the son that she raises, goes out and gets 3 college degrees, right? There's a way you think, there's a way that we are taught to think about that particular type of Black woman, right? Who is actually in Camden, who is working poor, right? We tend to think that this Black woman should be non-progressive, lacking love, doesn't fucking get it, right? And then here comes my mom, when I say to her, like, come meet me at my job. I text her, like, meet me at my job. I need to talk to you. And I'm feeling heavy and I'm feeling nerves racking my body. I am scared to death. Considering the possibility that me sharing or inviting her in, which is what I like to say, right, would be a cause for her to leave. She comes to my office and I sit before her and I have trepidation and I'm quiet. And she says, what's wrong? What's wrong? And it's clear to me that she is also ready to share with me because she came to my, she got there with the quickness, right? And I say, I don't know how to say this to you. And she's like, well, what is it? Like, what's wrong? What's the problem? Like, are you sick? And I say, no. And she's like, well, you know, do you have cancer? And that was important for her to ask because my grandfather, who was like a father figure to me, had just passed from cancer. So I say, no. She said, well, is it like HIV? Is it AIDS? And I say, no. She's like, well, what is it? I said, I have a boyfriend. And she said, I knew that already. I knew that already. Like this, and let me be clear. This is a Black woman, you know, and often there's this sort of societal idea that like Black people, one, are somehow more homophobic than everybody else, right? Especially if you're from like the South or if you're from like the urban space. And if you're not like college educated, and my mama, my Black mama, who had at that point hadn't even had her GED, sat there and said right after that, I know and I love you. You are my son. And she's like, and I actually knew this. I knew this for like me and your sister been talking about this for a long time. We ain't know how to bring it up. But that moment was, it was about that revelatory moment for me that broke that removed the bricks that were on my back. Yes, for sure. But it was also an intervention.
Yeah.
And in a narrative that is functioning within our world that refuses to acknowledge the love, the grace, the bountiful intelligences, the politics, the progressivism that lies within the heart of some of our Black mamas and papas and our uncles and aunties. You know, I come from a family before I knew what trans experience was. I remember bringing home a friend who was trans when I was in high school. I didn't even have the words for it. And you know, my family, they never asked any questions. And they were in high school. Like my sisters were in school with the person I'm thinking about. And they never skipped a beat. Do you want food? When I took my mom with me, when I was working with at Hedrick Myron Institute with young, this is the nation's largest and oldest LGBTQ youth serving organization. I took our kids, my colleague and I brought our young people to Philly for a trans conference. My mama came to dinner with us. My mama don't got the language, but by the time we were done, we were finished dinner. All those kids, trans young kids, young people were like, I want her to be my mama. So a big part of the sort of narrative was about giving the testimony or this sort of account of my own love experience. But it was also about pushing back against this narrative that says that our people are somehow less loving than some others.
What do you think it is about your family that allows them to be open and receptive? Like, do you think that there's something you were taught as a child?
Oh, I do.
Or do you think that there's some experience that like your grandma had or something like that?
You go, Tracy, you're going to laugh. I mean, the first thing I would say is, let me just apologize to all of my faithful before I say this. But I'm going to be coy here, but I come from a family of sinners. I don't come from a church family. And I do think that that has something, and I, why I say sinners, I can say that as a church, a recuperating, okay. a church boy, a recovering church boy. What I mean by that is, they didn't have all of these hangups. I don't think, all of these ideas, now don't get me wrong. There were ideas that I think that were about, that they had about how we might show up in the world in such a way we can be protected as Black people who are in Camden in a working poor mm-hmm. space, right? In a world that is antagonistic to us. But, you know, like, I don't come from a family that was believing that, like, if you're queer or trans, you're going right. to hell, right? Like, I don't come from folk who are like, you know, you need to be married as a woman to have sex with men or to have children. Like, my family's predominantly women. And most of the women in my family never got married. I mean, the first wedding was a big deal only because it was like, you the first, Ella, you the first person to get married. We don't know nothing about that here. We're not trying to, like, we're not invested right, in, like, right. patriarchy yeah. in that way. And I think that that's it. Like, I really do. And now as an older person, I look back and I'm like, oh, that was it. Right. That was it. Like, you know, there was no having kids out of wedlock. You know, like that, you know, like when my mom had me, it had less to do with her having a kid without being married. I mean, my grandparents they had their own stuff that they had to maneuver through. They were upset at the fact that she was 16.
Right.
Right. Which is its own sort of respectable right. idea. You know, I get it. But shit, by the time I was like walking, they were like, oh, that's our grand. Right. We love him. Right. Like, so I think that has so much to do with it.
Yeah, I like that. That they're just the judgment part isn't there. Like, it's like, who are we to judge?
No. No, because we, like, I come from, like, I tell, like, you can be knocking on my door after getting, like, knocking on my grandparents' door or my mama door, anybody door, after you just got out of, like, a stint mm-hmm. in jail or coming from a substance abuse facility. You know what they would do? Right. Come on in. And that's how I right. grew up. So it means nothing for me. Like, I don't know. I guess for my mom, she probably was almost like, why did you not think?
She's like, haven't we taught what? You? All, like, have you been paying attention?
You know what I'm saying? We taught you this. Do you see how we do? We don't kick people out. We never had an instance where anyone right. was kicked out.
Do you feel like you're able to uphold that as an adult yourself now? Like, do you feel like you're able to live in that legacy or do you struggle?
It's a ground of my politics. It's the ground of my politics. So, like, as you know, like, if you read the book, people got upset with, there were some readers that could not deal with what they understood to be my too quick move to giving grace. So there are examples in the book where, you know, I talk about violences that have been mm-hmm. done to me, right? And what I don't end with is what I think people assume to be true in the context of the U.S., where retribution mm. is the name of the game, right? Punishment. And I end a lot of this by trying to figure out and find a humanity in some of the people who had violated me. You know, like when I was a kid and there was a moment where I was attacked by some boys who were my neighbors. And they harmed me. I mean, they literally doused me with gasoline and tried right. to light a match. That's a horrific right. story. It's yes. a traumatic story. I'm not dismissing the horrific right. weight of that, but what I could not see a justifiable end, a just end, as that young person being placed in right. a jail. Like, that just didn't seem like, that's not how you grow. That's not how someone comes to a better place. What I saw is, like, maybe there's something happening where his mama is sitting with my mama and they got the kids together and they're talking about difference and they're talking about what was happening in him to cause those things to cause my being to, like, trigger him. But jail was never the end. And there's a lot of readers for whom who read the book as a version of, like, cheap grace. But I think it's costly grace. I'm not trying to say that accountability is not a process through which folk who harm must go through and endure. No. You must. Accountability is a part of that. And the ending of harm is also a part of that. But I don't see the means through which we tend to solve problems within the U.S. context, particularly when it comes to Black people, that we are so easy to dispose of. I can't do to another what the system does to us. So that's just, you know, it's easy, like, for me to come into sort of an abolitionist mindset. That was an easy jump for me to make, coming from a family that let back in all the people that that the world said didn't deserve love after they, you know, uncles who ain't pay child support bills ended up in jail. Daddy who was in and out of jail, but somehow still being demanded to stop his shit, still being demanded to stop the harm. And if you continue to harm, we're not letting you back in the house. But when my daddy died and my mom said, like, aren't you going to the funeral, right? And I'm like, how are you even thinking about going to this man's funeral, woman?
Right.
You know what I mean? And she's like, well, that's your dad. And yeah, he did some fucked up. I'm sorry. I cuss all the time. Tracy, forgive me.
All I do is swear. Please okay. Continue.
He did some fucked up shit, right? But he, I also remember, I can hold that with the good things, with the good parts of his humanity too. And it was such a valuable lesson to me. So yeah. Before I even understood abolitionism as sort of Ruthie Wilson Gilmore or Angela Davis or Marion Caba or all the amazing folk who had been talking about abolitionism, before I understood that as sort of a politic, as a practice, I had a family that modeled it, really.
Right. Wow. Have you, this just reminded me of one of a book that I love. Which
by the way, I just got to pause, y'all. Tracy got the most banginest earphones on right now. They're like, these are like astronaut. This is on some fucking Mars type. Okay.
They're the cheapest ones I could find on Amazon. Sorry. When I first started this podcast and they still work and I love them.
They're everything.
Wait, I was going to tell. Have you read The Reckonings by Lacey M. Johnson, her essay collection?
I've not gotten to it yet.
Okay.
I've not
gotten really, to it. But tell really me about good. It. Tell me about it. It's incredible. And she was, people who listen to the show are going to be like, are you talking about this book again? You're so annoying. But she was kidnapped and raped and almost murdered by her ex-boyfriend. And she wrote a memoir about it called The Other Side. And then during her book tour for The Other Side, people kept asking her, so, like, what do you think should happen to the man who did this to you? What do you think, like, what do you want to see happen to him? What do you wish you could do to him? And basically it sparked her to be like, my answer is not what you want my answer to be. Like, I super don't have those feelings of, like, retribution or, you know, whatever that everyone else wants me to have, or like, I don't want to do violence back to him. And so she wrote an essay collection on justice, and it starts kind of there, but there are essays about, she's from Houston or lives in Houston, so she's got essays about Hurricane Harvey and what that means and what justice means, environmental justice. And she's a white woman, so she has essays about her whiteness and what that means. And she has essays about the death penalty and children who are living with terminal cancer. And the essays are just so good. She's got a PhD in poetry. Like, she's, you know, a professional writer.
Yeah, she's amazing. And I also, I think about Josie Duffy, book is going to be on abolitionism in some sorts. And also Marlon Peterson, whose book, what is Marlon's book? A Bird Uncaged. Marlon, I'm messing up your book title.
It's
but
okay.
You
I'll put the right thing in the show notes.
But, you know, both of these people, both of these persons, Derek Purnell is also another person who's going to be working on a book on abolitionism, are, I think, offering within literature. I think this is going to be an interesting turn.
Yeah.
Because here are books that are trying to reimagine justice within the context of a nation state that has bolstered itself off of punishment,
right,
as a logic for how we solve problems. And I mean, you have like Angela Davis and Ruthie Wilson Gilmore and so many others who talk about what it, like, you cannot bring about freedom through violence, or at least solving violence through violence, right?
Right.
And I am looking forward to, like, literature that exposes us to narratives and stories that offers a texture of something very different than what we have felt before. And that is, the immediate rush when you read harm is to respond with harm.
Right.
That's why, you know, people were so upset when they read the book, because they're like, I don't like what I feel. I am supposed to logically feel after reading that. Yeah. I need to feel my anger needs to be resolved. And you are not resolving my anger. You just made me more angry. Like, how the hell are you going to, like, I mean, it would go off, you know?
Right.
And that's part of what I wanted the book to be able to do. I end up eulogizing my father after having lived a good number of years, saying, I don't know what I would do if this man dies. I'm not going to the funeral. Now, I went through that was some transformative work. The writing of the book actually, so my father passed while I was writing the book, which is probably a large reason why as a reader, you're getting a narrative that has come through a sort of self-transformative process. Mm. Like, I had to figure out how to write into the book a character, my father, who I loved to hate. And as a writer, I was thinking that it would be unfair to write him sort of monolithically, or at least myopically, without exploring the various manner in which he lived his life. So that's the only way, I think it was his death in the middle of my writing. Actually, I was like on chapter fucking 3, like, of a book that has 8 Like, by the time I got to the end, I was just thinking very differently about how to sort of talk about the interior life that didn't cage him into just one way of being seen.
Right. So that kind of leads me into my next question, which is, when you're writing your memoir as a, you know, young person, you're not in your 80s, you know, like, this isn't really an autobiography, like, it's sort of this moment in time. How are you living your day-to-day life? Like, are you constantly thinking, like, oh, should I put this in? Like, are you constantly analyzing everything that you're doing? And then you have this major life event that happens.
Listen, the real is, like, Tracy can see me now. Like, I got the light on my skin. It's like glowing.
Yeah, you look great. You know,
I got,
as,
like,
always.
Didn't look like this. I was not looking like this. You know, it was I was tore up. Yeah. I literally, as a process, I went for the first 3 months to write the first part of the book. I was in College Park in Atlanta, in a house by myself. And it was like, I felt like I'm going to use trapped here, but that's probably the best word I can use. Okay. Like, trapped, or forced to be with myself, with my demons, with memories, mm-hmm. with the feelings that came from remembering stories. And I would get up every day and set out to, like, I would give myself, like, I'm like, if I was at work, because, you know, capitalism, right? So it's like work shit.
Right.
So I'm like, I would be working an 8-hour day with, like, an hour lunch.
Right.
So I'm going to sit here. If I get to my desk at 10, I'm going to work 8 hours through until whatever, like 6, 7. And I did that every day. And I would sit there. And the process was, I knew that I didn't want this to sort of be a through book in that way. What I thought about were, like, what are the 8 to 10 thematic lessons are ideas that I want to get across. So each chapter is like one, it's a one word title, like run home. And so as I thought about, okay, here are the sort of 8 to 10 things that I want the reader to at least gain as knowledges, as something, what then are the stories that occur throughout the sort of life that I lived up until now that can animate or bring to life those lessons? And some of those stories, you know, after I sort of started outlining, didn't jive, it just didn't fit. Some of those stories were things that I was not at that point ready to talk about in public, because I had not dealt with them in private. That is to say, I wasn't ready, for example, to talk about the sexual assault I experienced. I didn't want to write about that in a book. If I was talking about reckoning, for me to talk about that honestly in a book would mean that I would have to go back to the person that did the harm and do some reckoning there. And I was like, one, I'm not ready. I'm not in space to do that. Second, I don't know if I want to see that motherfucker. So that was like that, right? So then that's how I got to the stories. And, you know, I love how Kiese talks about memoir and differentiates between memoir and autobiography, and that an autobiography, you're trying to sort of tell a story from, like, start to whatever particular endpoint is. Mm. Memoir, as you noted, is a snapshot in time. It can be a snapshot of an hour. It could be a snapshot of a day. It could be the snapshot of a fucking second. You somehow figure out through the art how to stretch out across a book. And because of that, I felt less pressured to have a tell-all autobiography, you right. know, I tried to share the things that I think would be most relevant for the reader to get to the point that I was trying to help them to journey to.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to shift a little bit. I have so many questions for you, and I'm like looking at the time and I'm like, holy shit, I'm not going to get to any of them. I'm glad that you're coming back. We're going to discuss Citizen. I'm going to try to yes. parlay some of them in there. So, but I'm going to try to move on a little bit. I want to talk about your new podcast because you just launched a podcast like a month ago when people are listening, maybe 2 months ago. I don't know.
Yes.
And it's called Being Seen, and it's yeah. about Black queer experience, male yeah. experience. Mm-hmm. You should probably tell people about it slightly better than what I just did, because that was sort of whack and it's really no. beautiful. And so tell people a little bit about it, and then I'll come back and say some things about
for
it.
Sure. So Being Seen is a podcast. Really, I like to call it a sonic landscape. I know that sounds fancy, but that's as a media maker, I worked as co-producers, Harley and Company, supported by Vive Healthcare. And I'll say a bit why that was important to me. You know, look, disclaimer, Vive Healthcare is a pharmaceutical company that provides HIV medicines. Let me talk about the sort of inception of this. Like, so Vive is an HIV healthcare provider. They pretty much are one of the major companies that have provided healthcare and also community services to Black men having sex with men, as they would label it, Black, queer, gay, bi, however identified, men, trans men, and others who had been disproportionately impacted by HIV. I came to know Vive through the work of a lot of organizing friends, a lot of my queer family members who are doing amazing shit in the world. Kenyon Farrell, Dr. David Melbranch, Emil Wilbekin, Lillian Rivera, folk who have worked for a long time in community with Black, queer, Latinx folk. And because of the relationship that these folk had with Vive, that was a door for me to sort of work with them. I'm like, oh, if they're doing good by you all, then this is worth it. And they're not pharma. And they provide pharmaceutical, but they do the work really in a community oriented way with Black people at the lead. So that's the sponsor. And they had this idea of how can we begin to, and really Harley and Company, which is another group that worked with Vive before to produce a play that was written by, shaped around the life narratives of, co-produced alongside of Black gay men from a variety of places, including the South. So they took and did these interviews with Black gay men to talk about their lived experiences and turned that into a damn play called I think As Much As I Can. I'm always messing up titles, y'all forgive me. So Harley and Company were meeting with some of their advisors, Emil Wilbekin, who was a former executive editor, if y'all remember him. He's a big thing in media, like Vibe magazine, et cetera. He's just amazing. He's also a person who lives with HIV, who's been adamant about getting our narratives out there. And they were like, maybe Darnell, we want to do this podcast and we want to do it differently and we want it to be great. And we want it to be centered on a Black, gay, queer, male, masculine experience. So they approached me and asked if I would be willing to do it. And now here's the funny thing. Like, I am not like, I don't really listen to a lot of podcasts except like, so I was like, I guess, you know, I'm yeah. a media maker.
Right.
And I was so invested in this idea of creating within a podcast environment, a sort of sonic experience that for once celebrated, centered, lifted up, involved at every turn, Black, queer folk, particularly masculine and male identified, in a time in which we know we fucking exist.
Right.
We are creating films. We are in Hollywood. We're on the streets in sparking up movements. We are co-laboring to create policy. We're doing all this work. And still, in 2020, still invisibilized, whether that's in the world of literature. Like, there are people that would sooner call my book like an LGBT book before they name it as a Black book that is sort of part of like Black American literature. So it was any opportunity I have to center those who are pushed to the side, I'm all in. I'm all in. And then not only am I going to do that shit so we can center ourselves, we're going to do that shit with excellence.
Yes.
So it is like, I mean, just for the listener, like the music, the theme music is by Moses Sumney. All of the artwork that the photography that accompanies, we have photography that accompanies each episode that was curated by Giancarlo Valentin and Texas Isaiah themselves, who like, it's by Black folk. the artwork that sits on the cover art by Black folk. And that was so important because I think what we'll have now is an archive of these lived, these narrative. I mean, you got like Lee Daniels on there and Michael R. Jackson, the first Black gay man to win a Pulitzer for a play. And
you know,
and
I know like, him.
You know, I love Michael.
So Michael went to NYU did NYU writing, musical theater writing, and I choreographed his main stage musical when I was in college.
Y'all see what I'm saying? Look, you see these connections? Uh-huh. Like these, and you know, so you understand why, how important I think this will be in terms of a living archive, you know? What I think what it inevitably does is saying we refuse to be a race, and you got to hear our voices if you can hear.
Yeah.
And we won't be silenced, and that inevitably what it tries to do.
And you bring in, I mean, you said it, but you bring in so many incredible creators, Black, queer, male identifying, masculine people, and it is sort of a reminder to the listener of like, damn, Black queer men and masculine folks they're doing it. Like y'all are like leaders so much in a space that I think you're right. Like there's an erasure, and then your podcast is a reminder. I mean, even as someone myself who I feel that I'm obviously very aware of Blackness, like I am Black and I'm aware of artists and creatives and all that stuff. Like the first episode, like you said, has Lee Daniels, it has Michael R. Jackson, it has Wesley Morris, who's like one of my heroes and I'm obsessed with. and so it's so beautiful. The listening experience is so beautiful. It's like it like washes over you. It feels so full and complete. And it is a little different than a lot of most podcasts out there. It's a little, I don't know, highbrow, if you will, you know, like it's kind of fancy in a way that is really enjoyable and cool. And I don't mean highbrow as like it's not enjoyable or like that it's like snotty, but it there is a level of artistry.
Yeah, my partner would say it's considered. That's what.
That's brilliant. I'm gonna steal that. It's totally considered. So yes, people should definitely check it out. It is so good. I'm gonna ask you one more question, then we're gonna take a quick break, and then I'm gonna try to ask you all my other questions later. But here's my question: in this time of COVID, a re-media attentioned onto racism and race, a refocusing by the white lens on racism, let's put it that way. We're post-election, but still, you know, the current president has decided that he's going to fly people from Michigan to come visit him. And, you know, we're just in a fucking time. We're all having a fucking time. However, your skin, your outfit, your hair, the photo that you sent me to be your picture on Instagram for this episode is just so beautiful and so just well done and clean and full of light and love. And so I need to know what kind of fucking self-care you're practicing, because this is bullshit. Okay. I'm over here. I have pimples all over my face. I'm breastfeeding these children. I have short hair growing in. I can't, my light is shit. Like I look like actual dog shit, and you're just always thriving every time I see you everywhere. So I need to know what you're doing.
I'm laughing so hard. But, you know, it's a combination. Look, I have good lighting. Thank goodness for Harley and Company. They sent me really, really good lighting. So I have that. But you know what? Like, we are in a storm within a storm. And I feel it. I feel the weight of that. I actually feel so much lighter knowing that 45 is exiting the White House. It's making me feel much lighter. Doesn't mean we don't have work to do with the new incoming folk. We do. But a big part of it is like Black people, we know what it feels like to grow up under the conditions of lovelessness. Like, I mean, this is like in so many ways, Trump is new and isn't.
Right.
Trumpism is new and isn't. We know something about living within a furnace. Mm-hmm. All right. I think what we also know, like I think about my family, you know, we're in Camden. We may not have a lot of money to pay for a lot of shit. We may not even be paying rent on time. But we were dancing. We made space for community. We made space for love. And a big part of what I've been harnessing in this moment is like, I've been spending a pandemic with my partner, Yashua Simmons, and like just sitting down at the end of the day and being like, you know what? We going to sit on this fucking deck and we going to look at these mountains and drink our wine or our good whiskey and just love on one another and be present. Or I'm like in a chat box with my sisters and my mom and we're enjoying each other's company. There is a way as Black folk, as folk who exist on the underside of power, we have figured out how to dance in the midst of the furnace. You know, not to be churchy. I told you I was a recovering church boy, but I'm gonna go here. Just roll with me with the metaphor. But you know, and y'all, and forgive me for my atheist. I'm not pushing this on you. Just hear me out. In the Bible, there's a story about these three, what they're called in the Bible, Hebrew boys who are put in a fiery furnace by the king Nebuchadnezzar. And Nebuchadnezzar is like, you know, an emperor, right? Like he's in charge of the empires. Then roll with the metaphor, y'all. And Nebuchadnezzar gets upset at the faith of these three young Hebrew boys and places them in a fiery furnace. And this motherfucker walks away saying, yeah, I done did this thing. I done got rid of them. And they're like, actually turn around and look. And Nebuchadnezzar looks and they're standing in the fire and they're unfucking singed. Mm. And not only are the three of them in the fire unsinged, but Nebuchadnezzar sees a fourth liking of a person in there that the Bible says is like the Son of Man, which might be understood as like God, spirit. And I had a friend, Kevin Taylor, Reverend Kevin Taylor, Black queer pastor, who once said, if that ain't a reference to your book, right? Like, think about your book. And so the title of the book, No Ashes in the Fire, really also has some, it is not just about me surviving a literal moment where I was about to be set ablaze. It's about Black people mm-hmm. who have somehow figured out, and this is not to say that we are, look, part of our work is to say we ain't comfortable in this shit. Mm-hmm. We're going to call this out. We know that the furnace exists. White supremacist, heteropatriarchal capitalism, as bell hooks would say, we exist in that shit. Mm-hmm. And this shit is not going to take us the fuck out. We are going to survive. Some of us don't, though. Right. Some of us don't. So what I guess I'm trying to say is, in a moment like this, for people who have figured out how to survive, pulled from our love, pulled from the sort of resources present within our own communities to support one another, we know how to make good. We know how to keep our skin clean and shining. We know how to keep and get that beard all loose, you know? Mm-hmm. I'm like, I'm going to put this good, colorful sweater on in spite of the darkness that may exist in the world. And that's part of being our survival mechanism. So that's how I do that. I wake up every day. And even I don't go to the office anymore. I go literally to the computer in my next room. And my partner laughs at me because I get fully dressed. Mm. I put on cologne. I wash my beard. I blow dry that shit out. I'm cleaning my face. I put little eye puffs, whatever they call that shit. They get look, I do all of that to go to the other room. But because we deserve to give ourselves that love, that care, right? Even in a moment like this.
Ugh, I'm so jealous of that. I wish that
listen, Tracy, I also don't have kids. Because if I had kids, I would not. Let me tell you what we're going to be looking like.
Yeah,
I
give myself a pass on getting showered and cleaned every day because I have 10, 11-month-old twins. So I am in the fire. I'm dancing sometimes, but I am also hot.
I get it.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break and then we're going to be right back.
It's important to me that the supplements I take are of the highest quality, and that's why for almost 4 years now, I have been drinking AG1. Unlike many supplement brands, AG1 is constantly searching for how to do things better. They're at 52 iterations of their formula and counting. Their team is always trying to find better ways to source, test, and find the best quality ingredients available. So many people have asked me if AG1 is actually the real deal. And trust me, there's a reason why I've been drinking it for so long. Quality for AG1 isn't just a buzzword. It's a commitment backed by expert-led scientific research, high-quality ingredients, industry-leading manufacturing, and rigorous testing. At each step of the process, AG1 goes above and beyond industry standards. I know I can trust what's in every scoop of AG1 because they totally obsess over product quality, the standards of manufacturing partners, and sustainable practices. Taking care of my health shouldn't be complicated. And AG1 simplifies this by covering my nutritional bases and setting myself up for success in just 60 seconds each morning. AG1 ingredients are heavily researched for efficacy and quality, and I love that every scoop also includes vitamin C and zinc to support my immune system, which is so important for me, especially with the germs that the mini stacks have running around and going to a cesspool called preschool. I've stayed partnered with AG1 for so long because they make such a high quality product, and I genuinely look forward to drinking it every single day. So if you want to replace your multivitamin and more, start with AG1. Try AG1 and get a free 1 year supply of vitamin D3 and K2 and 5 free AG1 travel packs with your first subscription at drinkag1.com/thestacks. That's drinkag1.com/thestacks. Check it out.
Let's face it, people have different sleep needs. While you love your partner, sleeping next to them might not always be the most comfortable. Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs, so you can choose what's right for each of you whenever you like. Maybe you prefer a firmer mattress and your partner needs something softer. Because of the individualized comfort that you get from Sleep Number Smart Beds, you and your partner will sleep better together. All Sleep Number Smart Beds feature cooling, pressure-relieving comfort layers for soothing sleep throughout the night. And their temperature balancing bedding is designed to move heat and moisture away when you're hot. When you're cool, they hold their energy to help warm you. The smart beds even automatically respond and adjust to your movements, so you sleep comfortably all night long. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
Okay, everybody, we're back. I did not prep you for this. This is the one thing I don't prep my guests for. It's called Ask the Stacks, and someone has written in an email asking for a book recommendation. So I'm going to read you the email, and then we're both going to give them recommendations based on their interests. Okay.
Perfect.
This comes from Colton C. Colton says, I'm looking for something plot-driven, a book that makes me want to stay up late into the night because I can't wait to see what happens in the next chapter. Books that are character-driven are amazing, but I just can't seem to get into them. Books I truly enjoyed are The Great Believers by Rebecca Mackay and Sula by Toni Morrison. Also, I'm not opposed to nonfiction. It makes me want to continue reading because I need to know what happens next. Nonfiction I've enjoyed is 5 Days at Memorial by Sherry Fink and Dope Sick by Beth Macy. Okay, Colton, I'm going to go first. I'm going to give you three, and then we'll let Darnell give you at least one, but you can do multiple.
Oh, my gosh. Okay.
You can just do one. Don't feel too much pressure. Okay. I just like to show off. You know, it's my podcast. I got to flex a little bit. Okay, so my first recommendation, Colton, is a book that I have loved since the first time I read it in 2010, I believe, when it came out, or 2009. It's called Columbine. It's by Dave Cullen. It's about the school shooting at Columbine in 1999. It is investigative journalism. It is, you're not gonna be able to put it down. It's so emotional. It's so incredible. I've yet to recommend it to someone who has not loved it, aside from, of course, some trigger warning stuff around, you know, school shootings, mass violence, etc. My second pick for you is young adult, because that's a thing that I'm into now. It's called Monday's Not Coming. It's by Tiffany Jackson. It's so good. I just read it this year, and I don't want to tell you too much about it, but it's about a young girl whose friend does not show up for school. And that's all I'll say. And it's incredible. And then my third one is another novel, because I'm trying to be respectful of your interest in fiction, which is There, There by Tommy Orange. It's a book told in by multiple characters. There's a lot going on, but it centers around a upcoming powwow in Oakland, California. Whoop, whoop. And I also don't want to give too much away around this one, but there's a lot of stories. There's a lot going on. There's a lot of plot. There are a lot of characters, so I do recommend paying close attention as the characters are introduced in the beginning. I actually wrote out a little character tree when I read the book, because someone told me that it was a little confusing. But it's such good writing, and it's really exciting, and it has great payoff. So those are my recommendations. Darnell?
Oh, those are good. Jamel Brinkley's A Lucky Man comes to mind. It was published in 2018, was a finalist for the National Book Award for Fiction, and is a composition of 9 short stories that really explores relationships between fathers and sons, and sons and sons, and Black men and their friends within New York. I was really moved by the book, and I would give that one.
Okay. Beautiful, beautiful, beautiful. Colton, if you read any of our suggestions, please let me know. Let us know. Also, for those of you who want recommendations for yourself read on the air, email askingthestacks@gmail.com. Okay, now we're going to talk books. So excited. All right, Darnell, we always start here. 2 books you love, 1 book you hate.
Okay, let's start with the books that I love. It's so hard.
I know.
Because, like, how do I pick?
2 books you love today.
2 books I love today. Okay. I think I can do this. Hold on, what am I looking at right now? You should see the books around me right now. I just finished Stakes is High by Michael Denzel Smith. So I should offer this. I mean, Michael is also my brother. But I'm not saying this because he's my brother, but because he's been a writer that I've followed for probably a decade now, and who has, in this most recent book, has really demonstrated his mastery of really honing in on the moment to offer the most beautiful cultural criticism, social history, in a way that is so narratively driven and also vulnerable. He finds himself in his words and self-reckons. So I love Stakes is High. It just won the Kirkus Prize. So kudos to him. One of the books that I feel like I should talk more about is Imani Perry's Breathe.
We did that on the podcast with Kiese.
Okay, good.
So everyone listening, you know how great it is.
I read that book. I think I might have read it in a sitting. It's a short book. It's a short book, but it is not minimal in terms of its impact or in terms of the stylistic way in which Imani drives home using epistolatory form, which is often employed by like Black male writers and sort of upheld as a thing. But here is a mama writing to her sons, as opposed to say Coates, who might be writing to a son in between the world. You know, like that. I love that this is a Black woman doing this writing. The book is so rich. It is so deeply, deeply emotive. It's evocative, it's honest, and it's penchant in terms of its critique that it's offering in terms of sort of the American empire and race making in terms of that. And it's just beautiful. It's a book that you don't have to have a son to read. It's a book that I think anyone can find themselves in. So those are 2 books that I love. One book that I hate. Damn it, I have never been asked that question before.
Really?
No.
Are you one of those people who doesn't like to say that you hate a book because you respect
authors?
No,
I can say it. Okay. I'm trying to figure out. I do respect authors.
Sure, me too, but I also hate so many books.
I'm trying to... Okay. So here, this is a book I don't... Hate is strong. Okay, y'all. So I loved Giovanni's Room.
Okay.
Because of how beautifully written it was, and there was a way that Baldwin wrote so fantastically about these characters, non-black characters, in this way, he gave these characters lives that are like queer, it's about love, it's about all these things. I hated that the entry point into my coming into a world where queerness would not only be sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Typified as a site of denial or violence or whatever, and also white. Mm-hmm. I hated that Baldwin used his gift to give me that book. I'm like, oh my God, can I get like a love couple? Like, right. Give me two men in Harlem.
Right.
You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, you take me to 135th and Lenox. Like,
right.
So I have a love hate. That would be probably the closest book because the writing is beautiful, but I'm also like, I feel like I missed, which is why when people, you know, are talking to me now, because I love Baldwin. Fine. But when it comes to sort of black, and maybe that wasn't his work, but you gave me Giovanni's Room, so shit, you could have at least given me, like, I don't know, Ahmad's Room or some shit. Right. I don't know. But, sorry. So I am more inclined to have found what I was looking for in Giovanni's Room in the works of, in the poetry of Essex Hemphill and the gritty black loving and also the works of nonfiction works of people like Joseph B. So. I think that's what I'll share.
That's a lot. We actually also did Giovanni's Room on the podcast. It was the third book we ever did on the show when the show was like a brand new infant baby. So, but.
Okay.
But yeah.
I'm going to get hate mail. I'm sorry.
No, you're not. Oh my gosh, please. Listen, if anything, I talk so much shit about so many books on the show that people love. Like, I talk shit about books and then I go turn around and have the author on the podcast because I really like the author, but I had a lot of problems with the book. Like, I don't know. I think it's okay. Like, yeah, I think it's okay to talk critically about things.
I do too.
Yeah, I don't just say like this book is shit and the author's a moron. Like, that's not okay. It's also very mean. But like, that's valid criticism.
For sure. Absolutely. And criticism can be love.
Yeah, exactly. What are you reading right now?
I am finishing up Sadia Hartman's newest book. Let me make sure I get the title right because I want to make sure y'all actually read this one.
And I will put links to everything in the show notes too. Okay, so perfect, people will be able to find it and go get it.
The actual title is Wayward Lives, Beautiful Experiments, Intimate Histories of Riotous Black Girls, Troublesome Women, and Queer Radicals. And the book itself is true. Sadia Hartman is a scholar. And what is this? I think he calls it critical fabulation. I want to say that's a term she sort of brings up and employs. And why y'all should see me. Y'all would let it is. That's right. I got that part right. So the book, while it may be sort of understood as like an academic text, right? Like the book, y'all, is such a divine piece of writing. Mm. Hartman has spent time in the archives and piecing together the lives of these riotous women, these queer radical women in Philadelphia, in this very particular time in history, and also trying to bring to the surface, given that their absences in the archive, imagining into being what their life worlds were like. And y'all, the book is so beautiful just as a writer. Like when I have to write, I typically will go to that book and just start reading her writing because I'm like, how the hell? Like it's like poetic. It is evocative. The things that she's able to do in terms of the, like she's mixing genres and the literary devices she's using are so gorgeous. It's everything. I'm just telling y'all that. Y'all go get that book.
I've heard it's so good. I have not read it yet. You're making me just want to drop everything.
It's so fucking good. It's so good. Seriously.
Okay. I'm going to read it. Okay. What's a book that you love to recommend to other people? Like your go-to recommendation?
One of my go-to recommendations, and this is easy for me, is Heavy by Kiese Lehman. I know we talk about this book all the time, but it deserves its praise.
So good.
And one of the reasons why, beyond the fact that Kiese is a really gifted writer, And here's the thing that I don't know if we talk about enough. Here in the works of Kiese, I say this about Michael Denzel Smith's work. I say this about Marlon Peterson's work, who I had a fortune of reading before it's published, right? here are writers who do something I don't know if we've seen in the memoir, and that is self-reckon. And that, you know, in ways that memoirists are often probably troubled with writing ourselves in the book as either heroes or victims, particularly Black men. Here is a work of someone who is laying themselves bare as an object of critique,
right,
as an object of study. And I think that that is actually very different than a lot of the works we've seen. And in this moment, particularly because I've been doing, I'm writing a second book, right, on Black man, on manhood and masculinities. And I am doing a lot of talk with this podcast on like Black men. When I think about examples of on the page of transformative work, that gets closest to that for me. And it's one of the ones I tend to recommend in this particular moment because of that reason.
Right. When is your new book coming? And what is it called?
You know, that's always the questions you ask the writers, and that just made us. Well, it should be done by now.
Oh, well, I wasn't sure if it like was, you know, already had like a pub date, or if it's like a few years down the road.
It's likely a few years down the road. Okay. It's tentatively titled "Unbecoming: Visions Beyond the Limits of Manhood." That's a tentative title. That may change, y'all.
Unbecoming. But watch out, Michelle. It's over for you, girl.
Well, you know, a big part of that is, you know, I had a chapter in the memoir that was called Unbecoming. And in short, what the lesson behind that was, you know, my freedom didn't come from becoming a man. It came from me unbecoming or unlearning what a man was supposed to. It really, to put it in layman's terms, when I gave my middle finger to notions of manhood that were pinned on me, that caged me, is the moment that I felt free. So this book is meant to be sort of creative nonfiction that tests the validity of that claim. I don't know if the goal is for us to become better men. I think the goal is for us to not become at all. Fuck it.
Right. I can't wait. Okay. I'm excited to read it already, but no pressure. You just take your time, you make it perfect, and then I will read it when you're ready for us to read it. All right. Do you have any like goals or things that you set up around your reading life?
Yeah, I do. I tend to read multiple books at once. That's just how my brain works. I have Sadia's book along with Saeed Ashton's book on Queer Palestine that I'm reading. And part of what I try to do, I try to sort of pair, and I don't do this enough, but I try to sort of mix genres and try to read them at the same time. So Saeed is a cultural anthropologist. I'm reading Sadia's book, which is sort of like this amazing sort of a historical lens to look back at the lives of these riotous Black women. And then we'll try to pair that with, say, like a fictional work, which I haven't gotten to yet, and try to read them all at once.
Okay. That's very cool. Are you a person who organizes your books? And if so, how?
Right now, literally, I'm in the quasi office / second bedroom in our home. And next to me, the books that I love are always at the top of the list. Like right now, I'm looking at Barracoon by Zora Neale Hurston. I'm looking at The Origins of Others by Toni Morrison, How to Slowly Get Away with Murder by Kiese. I'm looking at Coates' Between the World and Me, Educated by Tara Westover. So I like have those books at the top. And then the books that are just like, meh, are they like at the bottom? So that's how I organize.
I love that. And you're in LA, right?
Yes.
Any favorite bookstores here in LA?
That's a good question. So I moved here right before, like, I got here in October, didn't really travel much, and then COVID happened. So I've not been able to be out in the world. I will say that the places that I went to buy books when I was moving around was surprisingly the Underground Museum, which is an amazing museum, y'all. I love the Underground. And they carried my book and so many other Black artists' work that was just, that was phenomenal to me. So that's okay. Where I would go.
Okay, amazing. I'm in LA too. I don't know if we've talked about this. But
I didn't know that.
Yeah. We'll have to talk offline about where we are. okay, what is the last book that made you laugh?
Oh, the last book that made me. That's a good question. Oh, Tracy, you good. Damn it.
You can also say skip if any of them you're like, I don't
know. No. It's okay. Fine. Like, I'm borrowing a copy of, you may not think this is a book, it's not a humorous book, but okay. June Jordan has a way. June Jordan is like one of the ancestors that I feel like has been a spirit guide to me. So I have a copy of her Civil Wars, okay. That I borrowed from my mentor, Belle Satter. And for some reason, like, June has an acerbic, like, she just cuts to the chase and gives it like it is. Right. I find myself laughing a lot when I read June's words, not because it is meant to be humorous sometimes, but because of just the way she doesn't give a fuck. She's just like, here's what it is, and you're going to take it.
Yeah.
So that's the book.
I love that.
You all can't see, but I'm holding it up.
Okay. What's the last book that made you angry?
Oh, okay. So we're going to talk about this. More, but Citizen, because I was rereading it for our conversation, yeah. And I was just rereading it again, like, now. So I hadn't read it during the sort of storm within a storm that went now. Right, you know, I read it when it first came out. I was reading that shit, and I was like, oh, because you know, I don't want to go too deep.
We'll just say Citizen. Okay. It's gonna make you angry.
We'll talk
more. Okay. But I also actually agree with what you're getting ready to say, I think. But we'll skip it. We'll save it. Okay. What about a book or one of the last books that you read that you felt like you just learned a lot?
I have one that I just picked up. I don't know if you all know The Short and Tragic Life of Robert Peace.
I do know that. I've not read it, though. I have it. I own it.
A brilliant young man who left Newark for the Ivy League. Now, I have some things to say about the book, right?
Okay.
But, like, I always love reading books that are based in the settings of places in which I grew up and thought I knew. Mm-hmm. So, I spent a big portion of my 20s in Newark. But reading this book through the eyes of the writer Jeff, through the eyes of Robert Peace, who lost his life, was actually quite eye-opening.
Okay. Is there a book that you've read that you feel proud to have read?
Yes. So, you know, Tracy probably knows this because this was the book I was going to pick, but I have an alt... Zombie by Audre Lorde is one of my all-time favorite books. And it's so underappreciated. It is so... under-celebrated, but I feel like I am a better person for having read it. Like, the type of work she does in that book is unlike shit that I see even to this day, and I feel like I only aspire to be as poetic and as brilliant she was in that piece of work. That was some beautiful ass writing.
I've never read it. I have to read it.
It's actually amazing.
Okay. I'm gonna do it. You're making my TBR list go out of control, as if it's not already just thousands of books, but it's fine. I'll get to it. What is a book that you're embarrassed that you've never read?
Oh, okay. So I got it right here. I've not yet finished. You know, you're supposed to read all the Toni Morrison's books.
Oh, please. I've only read three.
But what's the book that, it's right over here. There's one of the Toni Morrison books that I have yet to even open, and it is... A Mercy.
Okay. Yeah, I've not read it. I'm working my way through slowly, I guess. I don't know.
I try to, but it's like, it's harder to get into.
That's fair. All right. You work with young people, so I'm very curious your answer to this. What would be a book that you would assign if you were teaching high school students?
Anything by Jason Reynolds.
Good. We got a Jason Reynolds mention in on the podcast this week. Everyone, check your bingo card. Yes, Jason is the patron saint / mascot / show crush. Everything he writes is just, look both ways, makes me cry every time I think about it.
Yep. I would send his books to my nephew who didn't really like to read.
And now he likes to read.
He read that one. I sent him Ghost.
Okay, I'm not going to fangirl too hard right now. I'm going to try to keep it together. if you were going to let someone else write the book of your life, who would you pick?
That's so freaking good and hard. But maybe Dinesh Smith, the poet.
Last one. I stole this one from the New York Times by the book. If you could require the current president of the United States to read one book, what would it be?
Oh, shit. The current one, and that's in the office right now?
The one that is in office currently as of recording at the end of 2020.
Oh, well, he doesn't read, so I don't even know. Like, let me think about this. I would require him to read. That is so hard. Damn it. Is there a book that, like, Satan wrote? Like, is it? Let me think about Satan. Who is, gets closest to I'm so serious because it's like, I don't even know. I mean, maybe he can read like Robin DiAngelo. I don't know. Like, oh, no shade. I'm not. No, that's no shade. That was a shade. I'm saying because I only want white people to talk to him. White people need to gather him.
Got it.
Yeah, I don't want to put that label. No black writer. But I would love for him to read Robin DiAngelo's book.
Got it. Okay. Brilliant.
White fragility.
Brilliant. But you're not calling her Satan. I think that was the confusion.
No. Robin, I'm not calling you Satan.
No. Okay.
No.
Everyone, this is the wonderful, brilliant, just the greatest Darnell Moore. He's going to be back at the end of December. We're talking about Citizen by Claudia Rankine. Darnell, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me. This was an honor.
This is so great. And everyone else, we will see you in the stacks. Thank you to Darnell for being my guest. Thank you also to Tamara Lewis for helping schedule this interview. Darnell will be back on December 30th to discuss Citizen by Claudia Rankine for the Stacks Book Club. Please make sure you're subscribed to the Stacks wherever you get your podcasts. And if you're listening through Apple Podcasts, please take a moment to rate and review the show. For more from the Stacks, follow us on social media at the Stacks Pod on Instagram, at the Stacks Pod _ on Twitter, and check out our website, thestackspodcast.com. Today's episode was edited and produced by Sebastian Alcala. Our graphic designer is Robin McCrite, and our theme music is from Tegirajis. The Stacks is created and produced by me, Tracy Thomas.